Welcome to Hydrofeminist Meditations, a listening series brought to you by Ensayos. Ensayos is a collective research practice born 10 years ago in Tierra del Fuego, at the southernmost tip of South America. Our work is dedicated to understanding the ecopolitics of archipelagos. We ask ethical questions inspired by the places we love. We ally with scientists and communities in the work of conserving and caring for precarious ecosystems. What we do is bring art and environmental humanities into the process of conservation. I'm your host, Catalina Jaramillo. Act 1. A glacier rhythmic audio collage from the Arctic. The Svalbard archipelago in the Arctic Sea is located midway between Norway and the North Pole. It's a geopolitical hotspot with a complex history. New transportation routes are opening in the extreme north as polar ice melts, and many nations have their eyes on new fish, oil, and gas resources. Norway was granted the right to exercise authority over this archipelago in the 1920s through the Svalbard Treaty. This agreement secures Norwegian sovereignty, but with certain limitations. For example, the archipelago is a demilitarized area. The treaty was signed by 43 countries, including the United States, Chile, and Australia, as well as Russia, China, India, and North Korea. Ny Ålesund was established in 1916 for the coal mining industry, but today it's a science village. It is one of the world's northernmost settlements. Randi Nygård and Caroline Tampere were artists in residence there in 2015. They shadowed glaciologists and other scientists doing fieldwork. This was no easy feat, given Svalbard's frigid temperatures and preponderance of polar bears. These are some field recordings and recollections from their residency.
At the time of our arrival in Ny Ålesund, the presence of light was consistent throughout the day and night. It was the end of April, and the sun had just returned to Spitsbergen in the western part of the Svalbard Islands. Ice, snow, and white landscapes as far as the eye could reach. After attending a course about the polar bear, that was in two parts, with theory and also shooting training, we were approved to handle a rifle and also allowed to independently move outside of the village borders. On skis and with rifles on our back, we staked across the crust. Along the Kings Bay coastline, we registered soundscapes and different surfaces of the landscape, while one of us remained on the lookout for the largest land carnivore in the world. In Ny Ålesund, the climate is monitored at several key sites. The bottom of the fjord, under it, in the glaciers, just under the ice by the coast, and at the mountaintop. Climate is also observed through the study of flora, birds, mammals, and high up in the atmosphere via different projects run by international science stations. Here's Angelo Pietro Viola at the climate tower.
Assuming that this is a kind of supersite in which we observe the same area from different point of view, radiation, turbulence, fluxes, gas, permafrost, then we see how can be explained the process in one place. And then we relate this to the large scale circulation locally. In the same time, we do long time series measurements to see how the climate change.
Clemens Weitleitner says,
You can imagine the glaciers like a big lung. It's breathing because there are a lot of organisms that do photosynthesis, and they also store a lot of CO2 from the atmosphere in the ice, but they also respirate, so they can also release CO2, and they produce nutrients for other organisms.
We found this image to be deeply poetic and surprising. The ice, which has previously been seen as cold and dead, was recently discovered to be full of breathing organic life, at the microbial level. Each time a glacier melts or moves, it reveals parts of the Earth's surface that today's researchers have not yet encountered. Kristin M. Shield studies this by collecting water.
The only data that we can really reliably get are these sediment plumes to see what's coming out of the glacier. But yes, you can see it. They do look kind of hazy and cloudy. Like, you have the big beluga whales that are there that really like the fish that feed on things that are growing where the sediment is rich. But then if the sediment, you know, turns off all of a sudden, well, now all those plants and microbes that really like sediment aren't going to survive there. So, yeah, it really impacts it. And also impacts how much light gets down. So all those types of organisms that really depend on sunlight, if they live farther down and you have a big sediment plume, they're going to die off. So it does, it really impacts the biology as well, which works its way up the ecosystem. So
one morning, just outside our cabin, we discovered small heaps made of ice cores. It was a delivery from Jack Kohler, professor in glaciology at the Norwegian Polar Institute. We observed bubbles and learned that ancient air captured in this ice can teach us about weather and climate on Earth thousands of years ago. The ice cores contained frozen information preserved in these bubbles. How many animal or human lungs has this air passed through? This air, having traveled over the centuries, now has a new life resonating in your body. Ice is referred to as a memory medium, as it can, just like an enormous hard drive, store endless amounts of information. However, this storage is dependent on steadily cold temperatures, otherwise everything is erased. What does the ice conceal in its archive? Stone, as an archive, saves old layers of information, while ice and soil typically yield information about younger topographies. Ice can store life as it was at the time of freezing. Of the three memory mediums, ice is the most vulnerable and unstable because of its dependence on temperatures below zero. Climate change is not only threatening our future, but to a certain extent our past as well. The ice archive itself can tell us about some of the causes of climate change. Due to the steady cold temperature and geological conditions, Svalbard is used as a test area for what one speculates can be real conditions on the planet Mars. Scientists are attempting to understand how life on Mars once progressed and what its landscape might have been like before it transitioned into its current state. Apparatus such as satellites, radar and drones, therefore, are being tested and developed in this so-called extreme environment on Svalbard. This is what Clemens Weitleitner says.
We try to detect organisms by this laser device, which can be used in space exploration. So it's all about detecting life, for example, on Mars.
This often reveals completely unknown microorganisms and opens up the possibility of gathering new knowledge and information from the far reaches of time, back to the beginning of life on Earth.
Thank you.
Act 2, on law and poetry. We live in a world where people are alienated from nature. Legal structures are invisible, but they determine the ways we relate with the natural world. The Ensayus project in Norway is called "The Wild Living Marine Resources Belong to Society as a Whole." That phrase comes from the legal code that governs natural resources in Norway. The Ensayo includes an exhibition, an anthology, and a series of events. In these, artists and scientists seek better ways to understand and respond to today's ecological problems. Artist Randi Nygård co-organized the project. She believes that affective, poetic knowledge is needed to deepen the relationships that we, humans, have with our surroundings. Now, we'll listen to her thought experiment on Norway's Marine Resources Act.
In Norge's Lover, a book containing all of Norway's statutes, I found that the Marine Resources Act, section number 2, really leaped out at me. The law says the wild living marine resources belong to society as a whole in Norway. I found it poetic, romantic, and paradoxical. How could a sentence like that be a law? Wild living resources are taken for granted by my uncle. He's a fisherman, as my family has been for many generations. We have to make a living somehow, he says, and for us, fish are a resource. Why then did the wording of the law seem so strange to me? Wild living and resource sound contradictory. Maybe because I've been blind to the way we actually live with and live off other living beings, of which many are farmed animals and some are wild. And also because the law seemed to reduce wild living fish, for example, to a mere resource. What then about the intrinsic value of the individual animal? Can fish simultaneously be individuals, resources, and part of our society? The Animal Welfare Act in Norway states that all animals have an intrinsic value, irrespective of their utility value for humans. To argue for or show the inherent value of the wild living, meaning its value for itself beyond what it means for us, is difficult. Even if it's obvious, it lies beyond our language. I still think we can experience it. This year I did an art project about gulls in the city of Oslo. I spent hours watching them every day. I imagined how they saw the world, felt the world, and created the world through their movements, their body language, habits, and ways of life. Then one day I suddenly understood that some of their calls were actually directed towards me. I had been observing them closely, but I hadn't really opened myself up for contact of that kind. I had imagined all their calls to be directed towards the other gulls. I suddenly discovered how limited my perception of them had been, as I met the intense eyes of the bird and perceived her calls as an attempt for communication. I sensed the bird in a very different way. It was as if she grew. We were in the same world. There was someone looking back at me, with whom I had suddenly made contact. We stared at each other in silence. There was a strong presence, unknown to me, but certainly vital, alive, perceiving, making contact. On my way home, I noticed how people tend to avoid eye contact as they walk through the city. The birds were sitting at the rooftops watching us, the individualists. We have not been taught to picture ourselves as part of the living environment. We have not been told that the wild being might tell us something or that we share the environment with them. That they are also hungry, thirsty, playful, joyful, sorrowful beings with their own interests. The wish to stay alive is not only human. We are often blind to the wild animals and plants in our immediate surroundings. And paradoxically, one reason for that might be that they are not resources for us. In towns, they're often seen as beings that don't belong here. With that in mind, the word resources may in this case also mean that we notice the fish and become conscious of the fact that we're taking their lives so that we can live. In the law, the strange term wild living was used because Norway has a separate law on aquaculture. Farmed fish had to be excluded from the Marine Resources Act. To me, wild living still resonates with power and freedom. What does it mean to be wild? That was cod making courtship sounds, and now we'll hear orcas imitating military sonars. The law says the wild living marine resources belong to society as a whole in Norway. The philosopher and professor Solveig Bø writes that to be wild living is to be able to move freely, and then one is exposed to the world, to danger, and to being alive. The idea about an untouched nature in harmony is also hiding the wild, because nature is full of traces of life. There are lines created by steps, and there are places where the wild live and change the environment. In this view, we the humans are also wild. We move freely and we leave traces after us. The law says belong to or ligg til in Norwegian. And one important reason for this is that the Sami Parliament of Norway protested against other wordings like are owned by when the Marine Resources Act was revised in 2008. The Sami Parliament is democratically elected by and among the Sami. And the Sami are an indigenous people with traditional territories within the national borders of Finland, Norway, Sweden and Russia. Belong to in Norwegian, ligg til, doesn't claim ownership rights. The strange word choice also suggests that society has a responsibility for the wild living resources. They lay to the society as whole, it says in Norwegian. The wild living marine resources belong to society as a whole in Norway. The wording is supposed to ensure that the resources benefit society as a whole. Yet still we have a system of private rights to fishing quotas. And today, large companies own more and more rights to quotas and less fish are benefiting the communities along the coast. Successful management of the oceans, we've learned, is not about managing the fish population per se, but rather about influencing people and their actions. As you cannot control wild things, management largely depends on building knowledge and spreading the right values amongst people. Do we humans have the right to harm the environment and the wild animals? I think most of us would say no. Still, we are in the process of causing irreversible damage to the world in which we live. Why is our conduct at odds with our values? Shouldn't we manage to use all natural resources in new ways based on new mindsets, models, and laws? In the ocean, there's an existential feeling of the self dissolving and becoming one with the world in a limitless moment. When art and poetry are at their finest, they can elicit a strong experience of something similar, something that cannot be reduced to information. It cannot be fully understood nor explained. And as I see it, artists don't need to make the world poetic, because the world is inherently poetic.
Act 3. A walk along Hulsvecken Creek, leading to a canyon of controversies. About an hour's drive south of Oslo, artist Sessa Jürgensen and Geir Ture Holm own and care for a farm called Evre Ringstad. On their farm, art merges with life. Grey water from their property feeds the Hulsvecken Creek, For this reason, monitoring and caring for the creek has become part of their ongoing art practice. Hulsbekken is a narrow, sheltered waterway that drains into the Sturmasan swamps. These wetlands also receive water from farms, forests, and residential areas in the municipality of Schibsted. Eventually, the Hulsbekken merges into larger creeks and becomes a tributary to the Glomma, the longest river in Norway. This piece was recorded with binaural microphones, so to fully immerse in the experience, you should listen with headphones. We meet the artist at the creek in midsummer, when the dreaded black fly makes life very uncomfortable for people and animals in Schibsted.
Now, we have walked down a 200 meters forest slope from our home to the creek. From our farm, it's only grey water coming down here. It is from the bathroom and the kitchen. But, of course, all water, including the rain that falls up there, it leaks continuously into the water here. Hulsbekken creek starts in the big Stormåsan swamps. It is the huge wetland surrounded by farmland, forests and houses. I'm standing here now at this slippery rivulet bank, and we are looking at the clay ground that makes up the bed of the creek. The color of the water, it has a special tint. It's like a little bit milky and maybe a hint of sepia, and it's only partly clear. Here it is clear because it's falling a little bit, but then in that pond over there it is more sepia colored. Here it is possible to see through and down to the shallow ground, and now we are observing a bit. Ah, yes, there they are, some small fishes swimming upstream. Oh, that's really nice. Looking around, the vegetation here is quite dense. And it makes up homes for birds and insects. And there are small animals, of course, in the water, and the bigger animals around. And just here, on a big trunk that is on the creek side, it has marks from the beaver teeth. And also the smell from the valerian is gone. And you can see the white flowers as small stars towards the lush green vegetation. No wonder that this landscape has the nickname the Amazonas of Schibsted. And now when I put my nose closer to the water, it's a certain smell that may indicate pollution, but with our bare eyes we cannot see it really. But this year, a volunteer group of farmers and villagers joined forces to clean the riverbanks from scrapwood and trash to make the water flow more free. The purpose was to get rid of the local black fly, the Simulium truncatum, that is a nuisance to animals and humans. It was the farmer and local politician Tor Jakob Solberg that had the idea for this initiative.
What happened was that in 1936 they changed some water levels in a river, and for that reason the black fly got perfect conditions. They say it can be up to billions of black flies in a square meter at that area. So in this area, we're not sure if it's any black flies that live in small water streams, but we have guessed that it can be some here. And it's some scientists that have been working for decades. We try to figure out how this small bug live, but the end of every report is that we have to do some more science. So for us that live in this area and have this trouble, it's very troublesome. And we are very into to try to do something. And we understand that we can't put poison in the water and kill the small rivers. So we have to do what we can to lower the numbers of them. In general, the scientists are living far away, and they are not—they don't have any trouble with this black fly. So they find it very interesting, and that for us, it's not interesting. It's a big trouble. It can be that bad that kindergarten can't be open, and people with horses and different animals—they have to keep them inside for a long period in the summer, where you really want to have your animals. Outside.
When gold specimen hits some other creeks, they merge and become a tributary to Glomma, the longest river of Norway. The name Glomma means great pale blue river, but sometimes it's green and brown. But it has been giving moisture and fertilizer to riverbanks and fields on her more than 600 kilometers down the valleys from the sources, beginning in the Sami reindeer grazing mountains in Gobrien City. Glomma has been fishing waters, transport artery, and gives energy to almost 20 hydroelectric power stations. This power, of course, is important to Norway's growth as industry, resource, and finance nation. Today, we are among the wealthiest countries in the world. All of us here gain from that. We gain healthcare, education, arts, recreation, infrastructure, and security when we are ill, old, or in trouble. Though our environment, waters, oceans, and atmosphere are suffering from more and more pollution and human mistreatment.
Can we change our language, turn from a gaze of desire, and stop searching for what we call resources?
Yes?
Hello, it's Mr. Creek. I wonder if you received the results of the test.
Ah, yes, let me see, Mr. Creek. The content of coliform bacteria is far too high, about 15,000 per 100 milliliter, and there is much carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus, and there are high amounts of cadmium, chromium, also copper, mercury, nickel, lead, and zinc in your sludge, and your pH is 6.5. Four at room temperature. Hello? Hello? Mr. Creek, are you still there? Hello? How do you feel, Mr. Creek?
That's a question I can't reply. I am here. I am running. But feelings are not something I can use.
Act 4, An Epic Journey. The artists Sessa Jurgensen and Geir Ture Holm have been collaborating for decades. An ethic of care is central to their work. Selfinset Skule, the Nordland, is a hyperlocal artist-run project that Sessa and Geir Ture founded in northern Norway in 2003. This project's long-term connection to a remote place inspired the founding of Ensayos. César Anguer Ture undertook an 11-day boat journey above the Arctic Circle in 2018. They traveled in a 16-foot-long wooden skiff called a fairing. This type of boat has been used for generations of coastal people for transportation, for fishing, and for joy. The water was cold, and the waves were big, and they rowed the boat with wooden oars from Surfinset to their retrospective exhibition 300 miles further north in the city of Tromsø. The entire journey was an art piece. Microphones were placed inside and outside of the wooden boat, capturing sounds that have been traveling through time and space for generations. Let's embark on the journey.
Try to imagine what the place where you are right now might look like if you saw it from the sea. Try to picture this place before the roads appeared, before the cars arrived, how hard it must have been to move around on land. In this game of thoughts, you shift from a map to a draft, and in your mind, the safe, dry land becomes white and insignificant, and the sea becomes green and available. You become aware of rules of conduct at sea, markings, poles, and lighthouses. You awaken knowledge of boatmanship, of waves and winds, of shallows and reefs. Imagine how the sea binds together, not how it separates. How sound is carried across quiet waters, and how fast and easy it is to row and sail rather than walk. Up here in the circumpolar north, people have moved in this way for millennia, from island to island, in an archipelago, to a small bay or far out at sea. At the horizon, the ocean meets the sky, and they dissolve into each other.
Act 5, a song sung by Farm Sea Salmon. The artist-run project Surfinsetskule went to sea in the summer of 2016. A 52-foot shrimp boat was a floating art studio for 5 days. Salmon farming is an important industry in the fjords of Surfinset. The group visited the huge circular nets where salmon are corralled just below the surface. The artist toured the floating farm, and a company manager explained the best practices of this industry. Later on the boat, the artists were prompted to imagine that they were salmon swimming in the farming nets. They wrote poems about what they saw as salmons, which artist Christy Gast arranged into a song. Caroline Tampere recorded her singing in the tiny kitchen of the boat and added the chorus of salmon. Let's listen to the Kings of the Rivers. Joining us on this hydrofeminist meditations. In the next episode, we'll continue to share our practices of caring for bodies and waters. Next time, we will slog through the peat bogs in Chile and New York. We're all bodies of water. What we do to water, we do to everybody, including ourselves. If you want to know more about ensayos, go to www.ensayostierradelfuego.net.
Hydrofeminist Meditations was produced by Ensayos during a residency at the New Museum of Contemporary Art. The Norwegian Consulate and the Australia Council for the Arts provided additional support. This episode was created by Caroline Tampere, Geir Tore Holm, Sasa Jørgensen and Randi Nygaard, with Ariel Bustamante, Pablo Tierman, Jack Kohler, Elina Våge Mikkelsen, Mr. Creek, Gulls, Ernst Risan, Tor Jakob Solberg, Catalina Jaramillo, Camilla Marambio and Christy Gast. Lise Doksæter and Petter Kvadsheim of 3S, Sonar Safety Sea Mammals at FFI and the Institute of Marine Research provided recordings of orcas. Lise Langor provided sounds of cod. Special thanks to Cato Langnes at NOTAM, Norwegian Center for Technology, Art and Music, and the Municipality of Skiptvet. Music is by Vera Dvale, and We Are All Bodies of Water, otherwise words of Astrida Neimanis.